We're going to learn a lot more about Cuba in the years ahead. It's not like Cuba is a huge mystery. The large number of native Cubans living in the United States and feeling strongly about their homeland certainly kept Cuba in the news over the years. But now that the United States and Cuba have opened embassies in each other's countries, the potential is there for the floodgates to open, for cultural exchanges and more. Southern Oregon University will host a number of events this weekend to expose people to Cuban culture and politics and more. We have in the studio with us five different guests and one on the phone as well. Reverend Paula Soul is one of the organizers of the Cuban Five Return and all the events associated with that. Paula, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
There is a photography component to this weekend's cultural offerings. Bill Hackwell is a photographer who's part of the Cuban Five Return and Entire Country Celebrates. Bill, good to have you here with us.
Thank you for having us.
Tony Sternod is an Afro-Cuban drummer and folkloric music producer. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you very much.
And he brought with him Jefferson Duvall and Kenyon Mayers. And Eugene Corr is with us as well. He's a filmmaker who made the film Ghost Town to Havana, which will also be part of this weekend's offerings. He joins us by phone. Eugene, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you.
All right. Everybody's on board. Let's get started with Paula. Tell us about how this whole constellation of events this weekend came together.
Well, I traveled last summer with Pastors for Peace to Cuba, and we went without a license to challenge the economic embargo that the U.S. has had on Cuba and the travel ban, and we brought a lot of aid with us, and it's a program that's been running for about 26 years. And I had a great experience and met Bill Hackwell and became familiar with this photo exhibit that he put together after the Cuban Five were returned to Cuba last December.
Let's start with a couple of general concepts here, though. The embargo and the travel ban you just mentioned. So there are diplomatic relations, but the embargo remains in place, doesn't it?
It does. And Bill can tell you a lot more about that. Cool. But I'll just tell you that that's how we connected with the UN Club at the college and got this whole idea started for a whole weekend of events to learn more about Cuba relations, Cuba-U.S. relations, and also just to celebrate the beautiful and rich culture of Cuba.
So, Bill Hackwell, tell us a bit about the continuing embargo and travel ban.
Well, you know, like you mentioned, it was really key last December 17th, and we're coming up on the first year of when the two presidents, President Raul Castro and President Obama, said that they were going to take a new course. And Obama actually, you know, recognized the fact that 55 years of an embargo had been a failed policy. And this was through 11 different presidents. We're talking Democrats and Republicans. And so it was really a bright moment. And of course, in the context of that, those of us that have been working on the case of the Cuban Five always said that that day was never even going to happen unless the Cuban Five were released. And that analysis was correct. And so they were kind of in the center of that. But back to your question, you know, since that time, you know, there was the opening. Really what's happened is on July 20th was the opening of the embassies. The embassy in Washington, I was fortunate enough to be there to really feel what was a very joyous day. I mean, people were, you know, after it had been so negative for so long, people were like, wow, this is like you could just feel it in the room. And this was filled with, you know, Cuban diplomats and also U.S. diplomats. But unfortunately, since that time, there not much has happened. And, you know, we could go more into that. But the basic thing is there's still a lot more to be done to end the blockade and also to reach normalization of relations.
Okay, I want to come back to you and find out more about the Cuban Five and who they are. I want to move over to Tony Sternod for a moment here and find out about folkloric music. Is a folkloric music producer. This implies that you delve into local regional patterns of music, it sounds like.
That's correct, yeah. There are ancient forms of music. Some of the forms are 4,000, 5,000 years old, and they came through the slave trade from Central Africa to the islands of the Caribbean. And in the minds of these very intelligent and creative people. And they've held these traditions, these very complex and intricate traditions intact, which is an incredible thing to bring them over the island, just in people's minds, teach them to the new generation. So these are ancient traditions. Folklore is basically music, dance, and song. It's a storytelling tradition, so it's a part of the history, and it ties the culture together in many, many different ways.
So we have the influence. You've got African influences and some native Caribbean influences and the Spanish language and Spanish culture in there as well.
Exactly. And also North American influence as well. You know, the jazz is big on the island. They're huge fans of American music and American culture. They are thrilled to see the relations improving. especially the Afro-Cuban population, is just really impoverished, you know, as most of the island is. But they're just very hardworking people, very creative, intelligent people, and so that they're very excited about what's happening.
All right, Tony and Jefferson and Kenyon did bring some instruments with them. We'll get to those in just a few minutes. I want to remind folks we're talking about Cuba. There is a cultural exchange coming up this weekend at Southern Oregon University. We have Tony Sternod, you just heard. He's got Jefferson Duval and Kenyon Mayers with him. We have Bill Hackwell, photographer, with us to talk about the Cuban Five return, and Reverend Paula Soule, one of the organizers. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to bring in Eugene Corr, filmmaker, Ghost Town to Havana, because that'll be shown this weekend as well. Eugene, would you give us the basic sketch of what you did with this film project?
First I might say a little bit, unlike, you know, Paula and Bill, I came to this issue fairly recently, the issue of our relation with Cuba. I stumbled into a youth baseball game in central Havana, Cuba in 2007 and just was completely astounded by what I saw, you know, which was a real community event, a celebratory event, kids from 4 to 12 years old just having a wonderful time. And, that was the beginning of following a story that in some ways, you know, compares lives of, Afro-Cuban kids to African-American kids in Oakland. I was just floored by the mentorship, attention, and love that the Cuban kids got. And the degree of support astounded me. I didn't come at it with any political agenda. It was really an exploration of the situation.
But you ended up making a comparison in the film between what you found in Cuba and what you found in inner city Bay Area baseball.
Absolutely, you know, and it's a stunning contrast. I mean, I came to the conclusion, you know, that for whatever reasons, you know, Cuba cares about its black and brown kids, and we don't show much evidence of that. And the film does draw some dramatic comparisons. For example, in the Bay Area here, Mill Valley is an affluent community in the Bay Area in Marin County. Little town of 14,000 has 31 youth baseball teams for kids 8 to 12 years old. Richmond, the town that I came from originally, city of over 100,000, mainly black and Latino, has 2 youth baseball teams, 11, 12-year-old baseball teams. They had no money to travel, so what do? They played each other 18 times. So youth sports in America are volunteer. We follow a coach, Coach Roscoe, in a tough neighborhood in West Oakland. How do you volunteer as a coach, when you're working 2 jobs and can barely make ends meet yourself? So the inattention, inner city kids is really alarming. And it's an issue that I just stumbled into, you know, walking into a game one day. You know, I really don't believe in agenda filmmaking. My interest, isn't primarily political. It's how people live their lives, you know. And anyway, that's enough for now.
Okay, let's take a call here. We have Bill in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about Cuba and cultural interchanges. Bill, go ahead.
Attitude that our country has had toward Cuba ever since John Kennedy initiated the embargo. It was a terrible thing for him to do, and our attitude has been terrible ever since. Well, there have been a few exceptions. Jimmy Carter said, let's not continue to punish Cuba, but most of the administrations have done that. We've done dirty tricks and all kinds of things. Very pleased to see that we're finally starting to recognize that they're a fellow country in the Western Hemisphere and start to treat, and it's time for us to start treating them decently.
All right. Thanks for that, Bill. Appreciate that. So, Paula Soule, in particular, you, your involvement with Pastors for Peace, is this a longstanding interest in Cuba for you personally?
Every summer, the caravan comes through Ashland, and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and Peace House host a dinner at the Presbyterian Church, and people come and give support and learn about what's going on in Cuba at the moment. So for years, I've been going to those dinners and hoping that someday I could I could take a month to travel down through the country, through the U.S. And cross over into Cuba with the bus. But this was the first year that it worked for me to be able to do it. So I've just been impressed with their solidarity with Cuba over the years.
And so what did it take to put together the – because there's a bunch of different events this week, and we'll get through the list as we go through the hour. But you got music, you got film, you've got photography, you've got discussions. So
dance.
This is a dance. Okay, a bunch of things to pull together. How did this all come together?
Well, I spoke with Kathleen Gamer, who's part of the UN program at the college, and there's a new international student from Poland, Michael Dahl, and he's the president of the club this year, and Tomoki, I forget his last name, is the vice president. And so they and the UN club and Kathleen and I started connecting with other professors who were interested. So there'll also be a faculty panel. I don't know if you mentioned that in your list of, but the on Saturday night, from 6 to 8, faculty from SOU will be speaking about their understanding of current relations. And so anyway, we began planning and just thinking how many different parts we could bring in that would be interesting for people.
Bill Hackwell, let's come and talk a little more directly about the Cuban Five and who they are, because this photographic exhibit is about the Cuban Five return. An entire country celebrates, and it sounds like the whole country of Cuba really did get into celebrating the return of these five men who were intelligence officers in prison for 16, 17 years in the United States?
Yeah, 16 years, that's mm-hmm. right. That was the longest sentence. Well, in a nutshell, it's a long story. I mean, it's the longest federal case trial in U.S. history. There were 20,000 pages of transcripts of the trial. Basically, what these guys were is they were five guys who were sent to monitor the activities of anti-Cuban, basically terrorist groups in Miami, who were responsible for 3,500 deaths after the revolution since 1959. It's a fact that very few people know. But it came in a whole range of different ways. Like, for example, in 1976, there was a Cuban airliner that was blown up near Barbados with 73 people aboard. There was terrorist operations in when Cuba lost its training partners with the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc. These groups started, organizing bombs in hotels and stuff like that. And, of course, the biggest one that everyone knows is the Bay of Pigs. So, they were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage, but there was no evidence that they ever went after, any military installation or anything like that. They were really monitoring these organizations and infiltrated into them. At one time, they got information that there was going to be an airliner from Europe that was a tourist airliner that was going to get blown up. And so they took that information, sent it back to Cuba, and the Cubans called the FBI. The FBI comes down and listens to the Cubans and everything, goes back, and in the heated area of Miami, where 2 million of the 3 million Cubans in this country live, instead of arresting the terrorists, they arrested the messengers. And so it became a very heated trial, and these guys got the book thrown at them.
What happened to the airliner that they were reporting on?
It didn't happen. They prevented many. It was like also there was a time in the Miami River where there was a boatload of explosives that were on its way to Cuba, and they unearthed that too, so that never happened. So it's hard to tell exactly how many incidents they prevented, but they did prevent a lot. And so, in Cuba, they're looked at as, sons of Cuba who defended the revolution. If these guys had been Americans, they would have been at the White House getting medals and things like that. But because, the whole Bush war against terrorism, you're either with us or you're against us. Well, these were anti-terrorist fighters. And so very dramatically, they went home on December 17th. And those of us that have been working on the case, I've been working on the case for 12 years. I was fortunate to be able to visit Gerardo Hernandez, one that had two life sentences on conspiracy charges, who always was very dignified and never said he was. He just felt, we're going back. We know we are. And I'm just like, well, good luck on this. And but we hung in there with them, and then they were released, you know, on December 17th as sort of they were the log jam in that whole thing. And so what happened for me is that I was invited to go down right away afterwards. You know, they had just gotten back, and you know, they hadn't seen their families or anything like that. So I was able to photograph, along with seven Cuban photographers, you know, public meetings, you know, very, very touching events, the integration back with their families, and very personal photographs of that. So for a social documentary photographer, it couldn't be better. It was like just this window of time, you know, from December 17th, I say, into the second week of February or something, where it was just all these events were happening, and it was striking, you know, because there it was. And so this exhibit that'll be opening on Friday are about 50 of those images from seven Cuban photographers, excellent photojournalists, and I'm very honored to be included as the eighth photographer, you know, as a North American.
Bill Hackwell, one of our guests on the Jefferson Exchange, a photographer involved with the series The Cuban Five Return, an entire country celebrates, one of the components of a large number of cultural events coming up this weekend at Southern Oregon University. Also in the studio with us, Reverend Paula Soll, one of the organizers of the forum, Tony Sternad, an Afro-Cuban drummer and folkloric music producer. He brought Jefferson Duval and Kenyon Mayers with him as well. And on the phone, Eugene Kaur, the filmmaker of Ghost Town to Havana. You may join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. And just as I'm looking over Tony's direction to ask about music possibilities here, because you brought some instruments with you, I'm reaching for a cell phone. What's happening?
Yes, would you like us to play something for you?
What do you got? Yeah.
Well, we're going to do we are rumberos, and we have a rumba troupe called Rumba Trujan, which is the rogue rumberos, yeah. And what we're going to do is a little demonstration of some Afro-Cuban rumba. And Afro-Cuban rumba, there are three different forms. There's yambu, there's wawanko, and there's colombia. So we're going to do a yambu for you right now on cajons, which are wooden boxes. And there's a little history I want to say about the cajons. This is a brilliant instrument because basically drumming was outlawed by the government for a while, and Afro-Cubans were prevented from playing the tumbadores or the congas. So the workers on the docks, dock workers, fishermen and whatnot, developed these continued to play these rhythms on cod boxes, basically just anything that they could grab a hold of. So it's the pervasiveness of art, nothing you can do to stop it. So we're going to do a little demonstration of a yambu for you.
Okay, a little microphone noise here while we make the transition, and then we get to hear from Tony, Jefferson, and Kenyon. Rumba action there from Tony Sternad, Jefferson Duval, and Kenyon Mayers here on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about Cuban cultural interchange, which is happening this weekend at Southern Oregon University. Tony, so any melodic instruments come into this mix as you're doing rumba stuff?
Yes. Usually there are a group of, say, 10, 12 people playing rumba. And right now we have three people, so we're basically doing demonstrations of the rhythms they're in. Usually there are singers, there's a lead singer, and then everybody sings the responses. So there's call and response, there's also dancing involved. So there's usually everybody who's watching and everybody who's participating is singing as a part of the call and response. So there's usually a lead singer, and then the congregation basically responds to the lead singing.
It seems like the music was probably the thing that traveled most easily across the barriers between the United States and Cuba over the years. I mean, we had, you know, the Buena Vista Social Club, for example, and there's so many other interchanges where the music just seemed to continue to flow.
Yeah, well, the thing is, this is ancient, and this has an inertia that's been going on for thousands of years. So to stop this, you'd have to, you know, I don't know what you could do to stop it. It's just really an amazing force. And Cuba is so it is the world fusion, and that's why it's so appealing to so many people around the world. Cuban music and Cuban rhythms are really just, you know, famous all around. Everybody loves it, and the reason is it is truly the first global fusion, and this is a fusion that has been going on for a couple hundred years now.
All right, we'll take a short break. We'll come back and talk more with our guests in the studio and on the phone about the upcoming Cuban Cultural Exchange at Southern Oregon University this weekend. So many different facets to it. Much more to talk about with Paula Soul, Bill Hackwell, Tony Sternad, Jefferson Duval, Kenyon Mayers, and Eugene Corr. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with our guests and your phone calls and emails when we return to the exchange in a minute 15. Change stations. This is, in fact, the Jefferson Exchange. We thought we'd give you a little Cuban-flavored music to come back into our discussion about Cuba and interchanges with Cuba now that diplomatic relations have been resumed. Yes, the embargo is still in effect, and so are some of the other restrictions, the travel restrictions. We'll come and talk about more of those. The centerpiece for all of this is a cultural interchange happening at Southern Oregon University this weekend. Reverend Paula Soul is in the studio with me, one of the organizers. Bill Hackwell is a photographer who was part of the photographic display, The Cuban Five Return, an entire country celebrates. And we also have in the studio Tony Sternad, Afro-Cuban drummer and folkloric music producer. He brought Jefferson Duval and Kenyon Mayers with him. And on the phone, Eugene Corr, a filmmaker who made the film Ghost Town to Havana. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You will hear the writer's almanac in about 15 minutes. Please stay tuned. But you can also join this discussion, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Eugene Corr, I want to come back to you and talk about Ghost Town to Havana and give us some idea of how much of a challenge the embargo and no, at that time, diplomatic relations made just in challenging your making of the film.
Well, in the beginning, I thought it was impossible to take a team from Oakland to Havana to play. The coaches, Nicholas in Pindolvana and Roscoe in Oakland, I introduced them on videotape, and they immediately wanted to play. And Roscoe, the Oakland coach, was completely enthusiastic about doing it. I thought, honestly, it was impossible, and I discouraged him. But Roscoe's mission really is to show kids there's a world out there. You know, a lot of kids are growing up on little postage stamps of gang turf. And one of the things Roscoe always does with new kids on the team is he just takes them on the Bay Bridge. He drives across the Bay Bridge, and when he gets to the other end of the Bay Bridge, he just turns around and comes back, because kids have lived in Oakland within, you know, sometimes a mile of the Bay Bridge, but they've never been across it. They haven't been anywhere. So for Roscoe, going to Cuba is merely an extension of taking the kids across the street, across the bridge, rather.
I noticed your quote about this. If this hadn't been a story about baseball, it would have been about ballet, opera, marine biology. It would have been the same thing, kids being mentored, taught, and encouraged. But you focused on baseball, and I wonder if the situation is similar for other sports for inner-city kids. I mean, you know, is it hard enough to find places for kids to play basketball and football or anything else?
You know, kids play basketball on the playgrounds. I think that's the most common game. There's a big illusion in America, because there's so many great black athletes, that black kids are playing sports. The exceptional black athletes, we have a wonderful system to identify the great athletes. They go to, they're recruited by colleges in poor neighborhoods, and they make, you know, billions of dollars for those universities. But most of the ordinary kids are ignored. You know, they don't participate in any organized sports, unlike you know, more affluent kids in more affluent communities. And so we are not making, you know, ways for kids to participate and connect available. You know, I began to see Coach Roscoe's, it's almost like the first course in citizenship, you know, how to get along with others. The fact if you play, you know, you kind of learn the law of cause and effect. You know, if you keep working at it, you get better. There's all kinds of things that that one can learn as a result of participating. And there are so many opportunities for Cuban kids to participate. It simply floored me. And the comparison is not one that makes us look good. And I'm certainly not saying that Cuba doesn't face problems. And I thought the parents often were really struggling. But sometimes I thought, Jesus, this is kind of paradise for poor kids because there is so much to do. The education is better. Family and community life is richer. And that's part of what I wanted to point out in the film.
And the film is called Ghost Town to Havana. It'll run 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock on Saturday as part of the Cuban Cultural Festival and Sociopolitical Issues Forum. That's quite a mouthful, Paula Sol. So I want to get into some of the other events here because we talked about the Cuban Five return, the exhibit opening. There's also a theater performance. Who are the Cuban Five? Mm-hmm.
Six students from the college will be presenting this along with James Donlan, who's directing it, and Bobby Arellano, who's a Cuban man who's one of the professors at the college. And it's called Who Are the Cuban Five? And it just explores in their own words who these men are and some of their experiences while they were in captivity in the U.S.
I see there's also time for student papers in here.
Yeah, and actually, that'll probably turn into more of a kind of a roundtable conversation. We didn't really have students submit papers like they would have in Poland. That's something that happens more in European schools, I think, that kids just like to present extra work. But at SOU, we didn't get any submitted, but we'll have a chance to talk with just whoever shows up for that conversation.
I notice you have Alina Senal coming to talk about Words from a Cuban Father.
Yes, and this is a one-woman show. Alina was born in Cuba and left with her family in 1960, right after the revolution. She was just 3 or 4 years old. And she just returned this summer for the first time to Cuba since she left. And this show, I haven't seen it yet, but it's has lots of music and movement and stories about her life growing up as a Cuban-American woman.
And then an hour of salsa dancing, it looks like, mm-hmm. followed by the faculty panel you mentioned earlier. And then on Sunday, there's more, 12 to 4 p.m., food, music, Afro-Cuban drumming and dancing.
Yeah, so that's another opportunity to look at the photographs, and there'll be drumming and music and dancing and a bunch of food.
We've actually got a phone call on the line. Thanks for your patience, Carter and Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, good morning. I have been listening to Radio Havana Cuba for at least 20 years, and people on the West Coast after, say, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon can listen to a loud signal on a shortwave radio at 6165 kilohertz. That's 6165 kilohertz after about 5. And one of the things that I've recently discovered by listening there is the Mali Cuba Radio Project and music that they create. And it's multifaceted, very complex, and very interesting and very exciting to dance to. And I thank you for this programming, and thank you for the celebrations this weekend. I look forward to attending.
All right, Carter, thanks for checking in. Appreciate that. Tony, talk about your influences and where you got into this level of music.
Yeah, I grew up in a jazz family, jazz musicians, born in the United States, but then we moved to Southern Africa, and I had a lot of African influences growing up. But returning to the Bay Area at an early age, like 14, I was exposed to these brilliant Cuban musicians, these folklorists who live in the East Bay Area. In the East Bay Area, there's an enclave of Cuban musicians that literally some of the best musicians in the history of Cuban music live in the East Bay. Grandmaster Carlos Aldama, Carlos Aldama, there's a book about him online, an incredible folklorist in the top five in the history of Cuban folklore. He lives in the East Bay, been my teacher for many years. And I'm the principal student of Sandy Perez. Sandy Garcia Perez was principal percussionist for Afro-Cuba de Matanzas, which was a very important rumba and folkloric troupe from Matanzas, Cuba.
Now, while we were on that short break a few minutes ago, you guys pulled in some extra instruments, so why don't you tell us what you got, and then you can play something.
Okay, that sounds great. We're going to do our rumba. There's three different types of rumba. We did a yambu. This is going to be a wawanko. And the third type is a colombia. We may get to that, but we're going to do a little wawanko for you guys here.
So here we go. Tony Sternod, Jefferson Duvall, and Kenyon Mayers. Tony Sternad, Jefferson Duvall, and Kenyon Mayers here in the studio at the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about a Cuban cultural exchange coming up for this weekend. Tony, for those of us who grew up with the Beatles in 4-4 time, this could be sort of a challenging thing to dance to. What do you recommend?
Okay, well, Miles Davis' Afro Blue is a very famous song in 6-8. Now, a lot of this material is in 12-8. And the beautiful thing about 12-8 is you can incorporate 4-4 and 6-8 and slide in between. And that's the trick of 12-8. Uh-huh. So this is definitely in 12-8. So there are elements that are in 4-4 that is, you know, familiar to the Western ear. And there are elements that are in 12-8 that are totally unfamiliar to most Western people.
So but every so often you'll find a beat you can hang yourself on because, it's the 4-4s in there.
Yeah. Well, you know what's really funny about 12 is it's an ancient form. This comes from, I believe that this 12-8 material was played when all humans were in Africa. So that's why we can all really kind of relate to it in some way, because little tiny kids get 12-8 better than adults. So you see little kids grooving to 12-8. They totally instinctually get it. For some reason, as you grow older, you're accustomed to, your mind changes in it by what you're listening to, so your mind rearranges itself to understand 4-4 time.
It's like the closing of the language window in the brain.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think we all have it within us, and it can tap in. Like I've been working with these students here, the incredibly hardworking students. We've been working for 3 months together. So they knew nothing about Cuban music 3 months ago, been working very hard and doing great, and I'm just thrilled to have these two students here. We would love, by the way, to have more students. So if anybody's interested in joining us and eventually being a part of our troupe here, you can contact me, if I may, at congadr@gmail.com. congadr@gmail.com.
I noticed that email address. That's a very catchy one. congadr@gmail.com.
Thank you.
We have a couple of phone calls here. Let's go to Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about Cuban cultural interchange.
Good morning. One of the reasons that there's not a lot of baseball in poor neighborhoods in the United States is due to the fact of the expense of gloves and such like things. I had a friend that was in both Cuba and Nicaragua at different times, and he said that in Nicaragua, people there play with arm as a bat, lime as a ball, and a newspaper cone as a glove. I'm wondering what they use for equipment in Cuba.
All right, let's put that to Eugene Corr, who made the film Ghost Town to Havana. Thanks for the question, Mark. Eugene?
Kids share gloves. We took some gloves down there. I think in the United States, the biggest problem is the absence of coaches and the disappearance of the inner-city coach and mentorship. What I saw in Cuba, you know, Coach Nicolas Reyes, he's a world-class coach. Americans just love the romantic mystique of barefoot, you know, kids, Cuban kids, playing in the streets. And there's some truth to that, but as a matter of fact, there are government-supported programs and teams and great coaches really teaching the game. Sometimes there's not enough, you know, gear. And in the beginning, the government actually didn't want me to film at Ponton, kind of a hard, scrabble, rocky, weed-choked field in central Havana. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen, filled with kids on an absolutely lousy field. The point is, you know, those kids are taking 20,000, you know, ground balls. So I really think the thing is that we need to provide programs in the United States for poor kids, and that's what's lacking.
But, you know, if there are just the two teams in Richmond, as you point out, does that imply also there's just a lack of kids interested in playing?
No, I think what Coach Roscoe found in Oakland is that, you know, if you have a team, the kids want to play. The kids absolutely want to play. I think they do like football more. I think a lot of the kids prefer football. But given an opportunity, every kid will play. The opportunities just aren't there to participate. Some people say, oh, yeah, that's because the kids in Richmond, they're playing soccer now. If I included in that comparison that I made earlier, if I included soccer teams, which are like another 30 soccer teams in Mill Valley, you'd see that middle-class kids are participating like mad. And the kids in Richmond just don't have anything to do. And you know, we know that humans mentor one another. I think there's a vacuum in poor communities. And so, the mentorship is something that generally society would prefer not to have happening.
Okay, right.
So I think what's happened in the country is that we've gone all in on punishment and ignored the positive side of what you can offer to kids. And the other reason I made the film is that I want Americans, we're an opinionated lot, you know, and I know that Americans often, when they go to Cuba, think that as soon as their foot touches the tarmac, they think they have the solution to every Cuban, you know, problem. And they encounter poverty in Cuba, which is there. If people do go to Cuba, please go. Please see for yourself. And go with an open mind. Don't compare Cuba to Marin County, you know. Take it as, you know, if you want to make a comparison, compare it to Puerto Rico, our protectorate, you know, with its huge, you know, problems, you know, of poverty and the haves and the have-nots and crime.
All right, we have an email here from John in Ashland. He asks, he points out that this summer for the first time, Ashland High School will send a group of students to Cuba with the nonprofit World Strides program. Do you have any suggestions for high school students in traveling to Cuba? Turn that to you, Paula.
Can I give it to Bill?
Sure, give it to Bill.
I don't exactly have the answer, but one thing that's very clear is that there is a lot more exchange that's going on back and forth. But the problem is that the blockade is still pretty much in check. There's only 12 categories that people can go. Some is like music trips, educational trips, research, journalism, religious trips, stuff like that. But it's really a shame because, you know, the embargo was placed there to punish Cuba for, you know, what they did in 1959. But it also punishes people in the United States. For example, medicine. The Cubans have made great strides in lots of fields of medicine, like they've got a cure for hepatitis B.
Really?
They've made great strides in cancer treatment. Probably the biggest thing they've done is they've come up with a cure for diabetic ulcers.
All right, so it hurts both is the point. We're almost out of time. I'm sorry. I want to ask Paula Sol quickly, where are most of the events going on?
At the art complex. Okay. So Mies Auditorium and the Marion 80 building.
Okay, so it's the Cuban Cultural Festival and Sociopolitical Issues Forum events starting on Friday at 4 and running until Sunday at 4. Music, dancing, discussion, photography, and more. Paula Sol, Bill Hackwell, Tony Sternod, Jefferson Duval, Kenyon Mayers here in the studio. Thank you, Eugene Kaur on the phone. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
right.
a lot.
Thank you.